She should be becoming this morning. She's becoming a
regular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she even showed up when there wasn't a
class. I know, she was disappointing. I felt bad. I was in Texas.
Okay, so last time we had started looking at some of the outstanding Spanish personalities, and today we're going to continue. Let's complete Ramban and then move on from there. So remember, we went through most of the written works, the published works of the Ramban Nachmanides, 1194 to 1270. We had discussed most recently his commentary to the Torah and the interweaving of incredibly creative, shot-oriented interpretations, certainly a greater allegiance to Midrash as an influence than, let's say, Ibn Ezra, or Rashbam, Rashi's grandson, certainly. So you have the Midrashic piece as well. He interweaves Kabbalah, we mentioned. He introduces, in elusive terminology, upwards of 10% of the commentary is Al-Derech Hasod. It's written with that in mind. And we said all of that together with an acute psychological sensitivity. And we mentioned that moving encounter between Yaakov and Yosef and the notion that it must have weighed more heavily for Yaakov and the incredibly humane and insightful comments of Ramban there. So that's just the most recent piece. And then also an archaeological awareness, which is very unusual for someone living, I think, in his time and place. So, for example, using the contemporary research with regard to ancient coins to try to determine the value of the shekel, the five shekelim that we talk about, or the chatzish, the machzid hashekel, and all of these things. So the Ramban really just, and that despite the fact that he had, frankly, no secular education. It wasn't offered, it wasn't available. It's not what they were doing in Christian Spain. It's just very different than Muslims in that regard. In a sense, therefore, it's almost a greater accomplishment. Mm-hmm. If you're in a milieu where everyone's doing it, okay, so you master it. But right, the Ramban really, it's unusual in that way. We did not mention last time, although we did mention when we had the special Yom HaTzmaut class, the last chapter in the Ramban's life, which is the disputation, or maybe we mentioned it in passing last week, but didn't get a chance to dig into it. We did go into it, I think, a little bit more at that class. So I'm not going to dwell on it too much, but we'd be derelict. We just wouldn't be offering a full portrait if we didn't mention that in this context as well. So just to review at least some of the salient details, this is not the first instance of a disputation in Catholic Western Europe, but in Christian Europe, but certainly as the first major one in Spain, and is for the Ramban, obviously, was the one with which he was intimately involved. 1263 is the year, so 7 years ultimately before he passes. He's already fairly elderly, so right, he's born in 1194. You do the math; he's roughly 69 years old. The Ramban is called a king, I think it's King James of Aragon, mm-hmm. I think it's James I, who calls the disputation. He is has been heavily lobbied by the Dominican monks in particular, and they put up as their champion, as their disputant, the well-known converso, Pablo Cristiano. He's a Jew who became a Christian. His intimate knowledge of the Talmud, that was his upbringing, that was his education. And Pablo Cristiani draws on that heavily in the disputation, in his argumentations against the Ramban. What's interesting about this is that James clearly wants to have his cake and eat it too. I mean, like anything else, he's a king, right? There are lots of pressure points and there are lots of people coming at him. It's been portrayed in different ways, but you kind of get the sense that he's certainly being, although he's being pressured toward a much more aggressive stance against the Ramban and the Jewish position generally, at the same time, he has some sense of fairness, he has some sense of maybe even inner integrity about this issue. He might not be, he's been portrayed as simply not as quote-unquote from, as right, he's not a priest, he's a king, and therefore he's more moderate at that time, right? This religion and extremism or antagonism, certainly in that community, that went hand in hand to a certain degree. And so maybe the fact that he's not religious means as religious in his beliefs or in his personal life, perhaps means that he's less likely to pressure the Ramban. It wasn't because I think he had, as others may have, you know, a more tolerant religious philosophy. I think in his case, you get the sense, although it's hard to know for sure, that it just he had less of a religious philosophy, but he also had a compass. He also had a sense, a moral compass, a sense that what kind of dispute would this be if the Ramban did not have freedom of speech? And he couldn't, if you would limit the kinds of arguments that one side could make, what kind of dispute is this? This is really, it becomes nonsense at a certain point. So you give the Ramban that freedom, yeah.
I'm curious. I have another question. I'm curious.
All over your face. Go ahead.
So were these disputes, so they're not just merely evil challenges. Was this a way of discourse that was happening with other faiths as well? Was, you know, this seen as a, you know, intellectual discourse that was, you know, was it a game? Was it a, as opposed to it being an evil, you're going to lose, you walk into, it's a gladiator, you know, scenario.
Right. Evil is a little strong, but it is for, if the purpose is to preach to both the faithful and the unfaithful, it's not meant as an even-handed way of of clarifying the truth in the sense that we're starting from a tabula rasa, and we all want to kind of get there. They know what the outcome should be. There are different ways to get to it, right? And they have two goals, again, to strengthen the faith of the faithful, and to convert as many Jews to their cause as they can. That said, there are different tactics that were employed. So in this scenario, it was through just a purely intellectual conversation that they wanted to make look relatively even-handed, because otherwise, how are you going to strengthen the faith if it's obvious that it's a gladiator match?
Exactly.
So it wouldn't be effective. So in that sense, yes. We'll see that when we get to the later period of Spain, for the classic disputation of Tortosa in 1413, 1414, which extends over the period of 21 months and involves upwards of 20 rabbis and many, many priests. Basically, the rabbis weren't allowed to talk. They were stripped away from their families. Right. They weren't properly taken care of. They were, you know, it was very difficult. And again, as we've mentioned, as the rabbis came to the disputation from their home in Barcelona and elsewhere, to Tortosa, the Christians sent their preachers off to their, right, the rabbis gone, and they attempted to convert as many Jews as they could. So it was, and this is at a more, a benign is maybe an overstatement, but it's a relatively benign moment in history, relative to some later disputations, but the larger thrust is the same.
Spectrum.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so so it's fascinating to look at it. We have both the Christian and the Jewish accounts. We have the Ramban's own account afterward, entitled Sefer HaVikuach. As we've mentioned, in anything like this, the two sides presumably have a certain bias, and so the way to reconstruct accurate history will typically be whatever their concessions one side makes to the other, right, that's most likely going to be authentic by all accounts. So if the Christians grant that the Ramban did a reasonable job in defending the Jewish position, so that would probably be the case, right? If each one just claims victory, right, and that's it. Not much to talk about. A reconstruction runs something along the lines of, and I know I have, like I said, the same bias as maybe the Ramban, but it's generally accepted at this point that the Ramban did relatively favorably under the circumstances. Does that mean he blew Pablo out of the water, that it wasn't, you know, even close? Does that mean that under the circumstances, given that he was intentionally the underdog, and given because he was on the defensive, that he more than held his own, which was plenty to say given his position? Something along those lines, but he, by all accounts, he did respectably. He brought honor to the Jewish community as much as he possibly could have, given the circumstances. What exactly that looks like, how decisive a victory or defense it was, I think, is a little bit lost to history. But at the same time, not only the ultimate outcome of the debate or the tenor of the debate, but also some of the key arguments have been recorded and are agreed upon in both the Latin and Hebrew accounts that survive. And the consensus seems to be that there was a lot of debate, as is not surprising, especially around the Talmudic passages, which is why Pablo was chosen, which is very interesting, right? Typically, we think of Jewish-Christian dialogue, we think of it centering mostly on passages in Tanakh that seem to indicate the supersession of the Jews by the Christians, that there's a Brit Chadashah, there's a New Covenant, the New Testament, and so on and so forth, that some of the allusions to various personalities in Chumash are actually prefiguring the resurrection and speaking about Jesus, etc. And there certainly is that, and you have that in other kinds of literature and Jewish-Christian polemic at this time, but this disputation centered much more heavily on the Talmud. Now, at first glance, the Talmud would seem to give the Ramban a strong advantage. Tanakh lends itself to various interpretations, right, and is much more very often ambiguous. What does it mean? How do you understand the prophecy of Hezekiah that the dry bones will be revived? I mean, you can do almost anything with that. It's not clear. It lends itself to multiple interpretations of the Talmud. You might think not so much. But the truth is that there were key passages that Christians at that time claimed in favor of their position. Now that, in a sense, seems surprising, but it's also a very powerful kind of argument. Meaning, Tanakh was viewed as the sort of the shared heritage of both the Jewish and Christian communities, what we might call now the Judeo-Christian heritage, right? That's both claim certainly the Old Testament, quote-unquote, right, what we call Tanakh, to be their primary text, and so you'll make one argument, I'll make another argument. But if, as a Christian, I can make the claim that your book, and only your book, actually ironically supports my position, so that becomes a much more powerful argument. The Jews' book, and right, their oral law testifies to the veracity of our faith. And there are passages, in particular in the last chapter of Masechet Sanhedrin, which is known as Perek Chelek, which is about who has a share in the world to come. And starting with that Mishnah, the Gemara goes off on all sorts of sort of exotic tales and stories about the Messianic era, what that will look like, right? We talk about Messiah riding on a donkey and these kinds of things. Many of those agadotot appear in the Sugiyot in Masechet Sanhedrin, and in particular, one classic passage, which has made a comeback in rate of recent inter-Jewish disputations, I guess you could call them, Lahavdil, but still, is the notion whether or not the Messiah, Mashiach, can be revived. Can someone who died once again become Mashiach? And the Gemara discusses the possibility that Chizkiyahu HaMelech was a messianic candidate, and perhaps he would have become the Mashiach. The Gemara suggests that he would have had he not failed to give proper shira to Kadosh Baruch Hu in the wake of a miraculous victory. As a Gemara that suggests that, it's sort of a call towards, actually cited very often in context of discussions of Yom HaAtzmaut, etc. In other words, is it more from to not say Hallel? Right, to say Hallel or not to say Hallel. It's sort of the argument that don't think that it's necessarily playing it safe to say, I'm not going to say Hallel. That's what Chizkiyahu did after he was saved miraculously by God, and he lost his position as the Messiah due to that that failure. So that's how it comes up in that context. But the Gemara suggests, one second, Gemara suggests the possibility that maybe he would have been the Mashiach, but he died, so could he be the Messiah again? There's one suggestion that even someone who had passed away could become the Mashiach. And then there's a comment of Rav Yosef from Gemara and Daf Tzadi Tet, I believe it's Tzadi Tet Amud Bet, 99b in Sanhedrin, where the Rav Yosef says, Shara le mare, which essentially means that God should forgive him for his heresy. So there's this exchange about whether it is within the Jewish tradition or it is beyond the scope to believe in the possibility that Mashiach could be revived. And this becomes a centerpiece of the debates between Ramban and Pablo. And the question is, right, can Mashiach come back from the dead? Can there be a resurrection? Right, that becomes part of their disputation. And that's just one example where this comes up.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, besides the Christian position trying to use the Talmud to support their viewpoint, didn't they also use these disputations as an opportunity to show, to demonstrate that there are passages in the Gemara which were anti-Christian, particularly passages that made allusions to Jesus in a very negative light. Mm-hmm. In fact, to such an extent that I believe certain sections of the Gemara were mm-hmm. actually excised,
censored,
so that they so they wouldn't be used in future years against the Jewish community.
Right. Great, great point. So there are two categories of that. There are the Gemarot that seem to just indicate that Jews are hopelessly biased against, or even have racist views, as it were, not literally racist, but mm-hmm. in other words, right, such views toward Gentiles, including right. Christians. That's one category. Those were often cited. I don't believe offhand that that was the focus of this particular right. disputation. But what they did discuss, as you might expect, also from the Talmud, is Talmudic passages that seem to indicate that the Jews killed Jesus. Mm. And those certainly were censored from the Gemara, including another Gemara in Masechet Sanhedrin. We have that. We have those kinds of passages. And they've been reinserted in some of the contemporary Gemarot. If anyone's seen Chaim Seiman wrote a piece like 2 years ago, mm-hmm. You can ask him about it. He put it out somewhere, or there was a draft that went around, and there was actually a prominent rabbi who was in touch with him and asked him not to post this. It's a big discussion because he felt that it could cause damage to the Jewish community to publicize such a document, and to publicize the fact that there's a censored version of the Gemara that suggests that the Jews seem to kill Yeshu HaNotzri. That's the language of the Gemara. Problem is that these things are all over the internet and they're everywhere, including by Jewish authors. There's nothing new here. Maybe 40 years ago we could have had the conversation, but in today's world there's nothing novel about introducing that into the public sphere. And so Chaim, I think, rightly published the piece, and we haven't seen, so far as I know, a spike in anti-Semitism. Because of that, I think we have bigger issues. And they lie elsewhere. But, you get the sensitivity that there was a prominent rabbi who wanted to push back against that and wrote a letter, and the whole nine yards, I think, is very telling about the sensitivity of the Gemara, although I would say not so much in 2015. But yes, those were discussed in this particular disputation, and there are many interpretations of who the issue is and what it means. The Ramban says, well, is this person, it was a different character, it was that, it was whatever. But those are certainly discussions as well. Really interesting ones. Class on Talmud on the killing of Jesus. Just some really interesting pieces. But again, that was published on, it's a really interesting piece. It was published in Jewish Ideas Daily about 2 years ago. You can Google it, you'll find it, but it's sort of a literary analysis of that Gemara, which is very interesting. But basically the thrust is that the rabbis use a certain kind of complex Talmudic logic to convict Jesus and make him the only person that the Jewish community, according to that record, ever put to death. And sort of the irony is that they were taking the very rabbinic account, in other words, the oral law, which is, and sort of the technicality, the importance of understanding the technicalities and how that plays itself out, which is precisely what the Christians had rejected, and the rabbis take that very tradition, they use it to respond and to convict them ultimately. So sort of a poetic justice to what the Gemara is really trying to convey, more than the history, sort of the literary... the literary quality to it. Sort of tells you what it's all about. Anyhow, so the Ramban, this only takes place over the course of a few days, even though it was incredibly widely publicized. It was a celebrity moment, there's no question. As we say afterward, the Ramban publishes his account. Within the year, the Dominican monks go back to James of Aragon, convince him to require, I think there was some sort of payment that was required on the part of the Jewish community, if I remember correctly, and the Ramban ultimately is exiled instead of going to more comfortable places such as other kingdoms in Spain or Portugal or someone like that. The Ramban, as we've mentioned, takes the opportunity to just go to Israel. He makes Aliyah with a family member. He comes first to Yerushalayim and then settles, as we've said, in Akra or Akko. And we've mentioned the Churva, the Ramban's shul, some of the letters that he wrote, the Igeret Ramban that we mentioned last time, which is a very short, pithy piece, which has been republished by Art Scroll with annotation. And that was written to his son, from whom he was distant. His son's off in Spain, and Ramban's now in Israel toward the very end of his life. Shema Bini Musar Avicha, he opens in that classic piece and so on and so forth. And he passes in 1270 in Eretz Yisrael, as with many at that time, there are numerous suggestions as to the burial place of the Rabban. There's the mandatory Tiberias suggestion. There are alternatives offered as well. If you want, I can tell you what I think about Kvarot in Eretz Yisrael. But I think I just told you. So, some of them are authentic, such as Me'arat HaMachpela. Others are inauthentic, and yet others are taken advantage of by people who seek to make money and turn them into such places. Thank you. So they have that. You have that as well. So. That's for another time. Okay, enough of the Ramban. Let's move on to some of the other classic personalities. Excuse me. And you have a student, an outstanding student of the Ramban, the Rashba, Rav Shlomo ben Aderet. Rashba lives from 1235 ben Aderet. Rashba lives from 1235 to 1310.
Ben Aderet?
Aderet.
For sure?
For sure.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my gosh.
Did he use his father's name?
His father's name was Aderet.
Oh, that was a male name.
Shlomo ben Aderet.
Right, because Aderet.
It's not like Ben,
it's a
you know.
Female,
it's a female name.
Yeah, no, no, it's not his mother's.
Somebody named their son not long ago Aderet, and I was like, why would they do that to their son?
Yeah, no, it's.
The idea of Aderet.
Right.
Yeah, that's interesting. Sure, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know. That is a good point. But this is, you know, it's a long time before the modern usage, so.
Right.
But that's a good point. That, by the way, I don't remember offhand the Rashba's Spanish name, but contemporarily they would not have gone as Shlomo ben Aderet. They would have gone by names like Benavisti and such names. I don't remember. It might have been the Rashba's last name. I forget. But they actually, that's not how they were known contemporarily, certainly in the wider community. But that's, at this point, not living in that, being included in that milieu, that's what we generally refer to.
Unfortunately, like everybody in the Gola did go with a...
They went with the secular name as well. That's also a good shear, by the way. Okay. There's a Tosafist whose name is Rabbeinu Peter.
Oh, wow.
Peter is, of course, Peter. Yeah.
Peter, Patrick.
That's love from Peter Rechem.
Yes, what? You know, well, I don't know which one was better or worse, right? right? Okay. The donkey. All right. Anyhow. Okay. So the Rashba. Excuse me. The Rashba is a student of Rabbeinu Yonah. The Rashba is a student of the Ramban. He's a sort of a younger contemporary slash student. Again, an outstanding scholar, first and foremost in Talmud and Halakha. He writes a commentary which is widely used today, much as the Ramban and Rabbeinu Yonah are widely distributed and widely learned. He's called Chidushei HaRashba al Hashas, his novella on the Gemara. Again, there's a, I don't know if I have a volume here right now, but there's, I don't see one on the shelf, but it's a series of, usually, typically now published by Mossad Rav Kook, which is a well-known publishing agency in Israel. It's thin to thick, depending on the tractate, the Masechet, blue volumes. It's ubiquitous. You find it in pretty much all yeshivot, all over the place. He writes responsa, much more than the Ramban, interestingly enough. We have volumes upon volumes upon volumes of responsa from him. In fact, it gets so confusing, gets into the thousands, and it starts getting really complicated with the numbering on the Bar Ilan Siddi, because at a certain point it kind of exceeds their typical numeration. It's just, he was prolific, especially in the area of halakha, in a way that perhaps the Ramban was not. The Ramban wrote his commentary on Chumash. The Ramban writes on philosophy and so on and so forth. The Rashba, not as much, but his legal responsa are staggering in their sheer output.
Sorry, from what year to what year?
1235 to 1310, roughly. We don't always know.
To what?
To 1310. He's also very often quoted in areas of practical halakha that we study nowadays, especially the laws of kashrut, as well as the laws of Yom Tov. He has not just kashrut, nida, and other areas in what we call nowadays yoredei'ah. that wider area of Isur Veheter, the laws of Shechita, the laws of salting of Melicha, which mercifully are not as relevant as they were some time ago, kindly. And although there are some Smicha programs that still learn the laws of salting, laws of Shabbat not so much, but the laws of salting that we have to know.
So,
they had Melicha. Right, they learned Melicha. Unbelievable. Right, and then it stayed in certain Smicha programs. It stayed on the curriculum. Like, it's like they have like a 20-year corrective time. It's like 20 years later, it's like, oh, they don't really do this anymore. Oh, maybe we should substitute it for something that actually is relevant for rabbis to know practically. I mean, it's all important. It's all good, but you have to make decisions. That's what curricula are. Right?
Although some rabbis go into the area of kashrus or
right.
Or kashrus so right. or hashgacha.
Absolutely.
Then they need to have that background.
Absolutely. Right. So I think that what you do is that you have to create specialized courses which are particular,
yeah.
Right? Because otherwise what you do is you have 90%, I agree with you, otherwise you have 90% of the people who are studying something know that they're almost certainly not going to encounter it. So, and how are they, you know, are they really going to engage in that? You know, it just doesn't. So I agree, there need to be specialized courses. I don't mean to say it's not.
But not part of the core curriculum, so to speak.
Exactly. That's more universal.
To borrow a term from academia.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. What?
Minor insulting.
Or elective. I'm elective.
Okay, very good. Okay, so, but the Rashba was very highly relevant for him. By the way, there was a work, a Ashkenazic work, which I have sitting on my bookshelf downstairs at home, which is called Sefer Nikur Hagid, which is an entire work dedicated to the halachot of removing the gid hanasha, the sciatic nerve. There's a whole literature how you do that properly. The entire sefer dedicated to removing the gid hanasha, right? Even that they don't teach contemporarily, but it's, I think, like it's a 13th century work, and that's you have to write a sefer on it, right? Like trephos, you know, all these kinds of things. Okay, so the Rashba does write on some of these topics, and is often, especially where relevant to our core curriculum, is often studied. He has one work called Torat Habayit, which are essentially a summary and an in-depth analysis of the laws of kashrut, including shechita, including signs of kosher and non-kosher animals, including laws of meat and milk, including laws of ta'aruvot, in other words, when kosher and non-kosher foods are mixed together, meat and milk are mixed together, how to keep a kosher kitchen, all those kinds of things, the laws of nidah as well, the laws of mikvah, etc., all of those encompassed in one work called Torat Habayit. He has another one on the laws of Yom Tov, also studied a little bit less regularly, but still in use nowadays. And those are highly influential works that appear all over Shulchan Aruch in the area of what's typically studied in a smicha type of curriculum. Philosophically, the Rashba is, again, not focused on, not interested on philosophy in the same way as the Rambam, as many at this time were not. And he also has this dialectic or tension in much the way that the Ramban does. On the one hand, a real reverence for the Rambam and what he brought to the community and for that whole movement, and yet a concern about the possibility of philosophy leading youth in particular astray. And he really goes back and forth almost on this. There are a number of people who get him to sign on to a ban originally, suggesting that at least students who are below a certain age not study philosophy until they've sort of filled their stomach, as it were, with meat and potatoes before they're ready to move on to other areas of study. So there's a lot of, again, the sort of trying to strike the right balance. And again, what happens when you take ideas that germinated in the same country but on very different soil and you transplant that into a new part of the Jewish community just 100 years later? Interesting things happen and result. Again, the Rambam died in 1204 and the Rashba in 1310. It's 100 years. Mm-hmm. It's a long time. 100 years is right. Although things didn't generally move quite as quickly philosophically then as they do today. But it's interesting to kind of play that kind of issue out. So you start to see that there's this chain, right?
It's, we have still the same
issue. What?
Everything old is new again.
We still, oh my goodness, issue. Right? I mean, that's what's so interesting, to see the Maimonidean controversies, because they're fighting about, and there are these letters, and you can actually get, and I'll hopefully bring in for a future class, you actually see the letters that were published back and forth in defense of these bans, in support of it, right, in response to them. There are lots of polemical writings back and forth about these issues. And it is, it's very much contemporary. It's really, it's fascinating to see, 100%. But you start to see now that there was, excuse me, that there's sort of a line. And you start with, you have, right, Rabbeinu Yonah, and then you have the Ramban, and you have the Rashba. These are what we call the Chachmei Svarad, some of the outstanding Svaritic scholars in particular that are studied on the Gemara nowadays. And the next one in that chain is known as the Ritva. Rabbeinu Yom Tov Ashbeli is Ashbeli, we say it in Hebrew. Ashbeli, Aseveli. Aseveli was probably closer to the Spanish.
And you know what?
Yeah.
My maiden name is Azubel.
Okay.
And it's we all the time, like, what it is, and it's Asabel, and they said, Rabbi Yom Tov Asabeli.
There you go. Okay.
Yichus.
Do you have the family? Do you have to find the family tree? No, we don't have it.
I mean, we want to try to be Spanish citizens. But and we were like, how are we going to prove the head of the organization of the Spanish is something Azubel? So I'm like, okay, we have the same last name.
Right. Okay. Well, there you have it. So the Ritva is certainly part of this tradition and a prominent one at that. That's really interesting. His books are published also by Mossad Rav Kook, but they're in a light beige as opposed to the dark blue hue. So, FYI, next time you see them. But the Ritva is that next generation, 13th to the 14th century, a student of Rashba, commentary on Shas, on the Gemara, again, pretty much the entirety of the Gemara all the way through, part of that same tradition. What's interesting about the Ritva is his writing is even more accessible than those who preceded him. The Ramban's novella on the Gemara in particular, very hard to make out. They're very compact, they're somewhat abstruse, they're hard, it's really hard work. And the Ritva is not like light reading, I wouldn't recommend it, you know. It's not quite like an easy novel or something like that. So I don't mean to say that it's just, you know, it's easy bedtime reading, but for someone who's learned the Gemara and then wants to see a medieval commentary on it, the Ritva has a freer style, a clearer kind of approach. He doesn't require as much from the reader as does the Ramban and even then the Rashba. So he's often consulted as someone who is a little bit easier to access. If you want to teach students to begin to study the Chachmei Svarad, sometimes it's easier to begin with the commentary of the Ritva and then you work your way from there. That is he. So that's his claim to fame in this tradition is that he makes it a little bit more exoteric. Their Talmudic commentary is just a little bit more accessible. He also is interested in philosophy, also has the same thing, the same kind of balance where he's kind of dancing at both simchas, the pro-Rambam, but concerned about philosophy. He writes a small philosophical work, it's still in use today, called Sefer HaZikaron. Sefer HaZikaron, and it is, interestingly enough, a moderate defense of difficult passages in the Rambam, that interestingly enough, were attacked by the Ramban. So the Ramban sometimes was critical of the Rambam, which is not surprising, right? The Ramban influenced by the mystical tradition, the Rambam is the arch-rationalist, and so inevitably there were going to be times when they disagree, and that happened fairly often, about some key issues. So for example, the Rambam has, one of the most famous examples, the Rambam has his, I don't think we mentioned this yet, the Rambam has his classic suggestion in his Guide to the Perplexed and the Moreh Nevuchim that sacrifices are merely a concession to human frailty and that God ultimately wanted to phase them out. The Ramban takes terrible offense to this suggestion, finds it theologically untenable and objectionable. The Ramban says basically, you're taking one of the central aspects of our entire tradition and you're basically saying, well, actually, that's just a concession to human frailty, but the ideal is to get rid of the whole thing. The Ramban finds that to be untenable. If the Torah is eternal, right? So this is clearly, speaking with contemporary resonance, right? This has that as well. And these debates are cited and in many ways being continued as well in other contexts about change in halakha and so on and so forth. The the Ramban is that what's interesting for our purposes is that the Ritva comes, interestingly enough, to the defense of the Rambam, except in coming to the defense of the Rambam, he almost reinterprets the Rambam to the point that it's questionable whether or not it's even a tenable reading of the Rambam. In other words, this is like perfect, right? In other words, he's taking the Rambam, but he's almost turning him into a philosophical position that's more amenable to someone in Christian Spain. Right? So on the one hand, he's coming to the defense of the Rambam, on the other hand, he's sort of reinterpreting it in a way that really moderates what the Rambam was trying to say. He suggests that the Rambam was only relevant to certain sacrifices and not to all sacrifices, and so on and so forth. And certainly in the Messianic era, the Rambam agrees that the full-fledged sacrifices will return, which is actually true, and that's part of the complexity of the Maimonidean position, even aside from all the sort of apologetics and the questions. But so it's a complicated position even internally within the Rambam, which is, I think, right. If you read, there are other passages. Sometimes what happens is you have one passage, it gets all the celebrity attention, and that's all anyone pays attention to. But in fact, if you read the whole Moreh from beginning to end, and you read the Mishnah Torah and the other writings of the Rambam, you see it's a much more complex and nuanced picture. This is, I think, a good example of that, without any apologetics or agendas. It's a complicated position. But the Ritva, it's not surprising that, he's kind of having his cake and eating it too. He's dancing at the Rambam Simcha from the vantage point of Christian Spain. Mm-hmm. So you see that the philosophical tensions continue. Then we come to the next one in the chain. So we've got right now, it's pretty remarkable to see this uninterrupted. You don't have this in the same way in the latter period of Christian Spain, because it's just the community is not together in the same way because of the persecution. But the earlier times, although things were difficult and there was plenty of anti-Semitism to write home about, it was stable enough that there was real continuity. So Rabbeinu Yonah, right, and the Ramban, and the Rashba, and the Ritva, and now we come to the Ran, Rabbeinu Nissim, a 14th century scholar. We don't know his exact dates. In general, his biography is a little bit less clear than some of his predecessors. But the Ran also, Rabbeinu Nissim also writes on the Gemara, has many classic commentaries. These are printed typically not as in, he has some that are independent novella, fewer than some of his predecessors, the Chidushei Haran on the Gemara, and some of the tractates. Actually, it's a handful, but it's not as comprehensive as the Ramban, the Rashba, and the Ritva. And it's also printed on the page of the Rif as well. He wrote commentary to the Rif. We've mentioned that in the Sephardic circles, which were a little bit more practically oriented, halacha lemaaseh, it was not uncommon to study, to have a more practical bent, and therefore study the Rif, which is sort of a halachic digest, as we've said. So the Ran's commentary was intentionally printed on the Rif because people were studying the Rif. And if they study the Rif, then there's a good chance they'll study the commentaries that are written on the Rif. This is a classic tactic with regard to publishing that you have, not only in the world of halacha or in the Jewish world, we have all over the place, which is, if I'm learning a living in a particular time and place, and I know that it's common to study a certain kind of work, so what I might do is I'll write my commentary surrounding that work such that it will make it more likely that my work will be studied. Right? That's good head, right?
You think that he would think like this, writing?
The publisher may have thought like this as opposed to he. I don't know. Okay. But, he did write a commentary on the Rif. You certainly have that later on. I'll give you an example.
Write it because you want to write it because you feel that you have something to say, not because you want to publish it.
For sure. But the question is, so I go to write my work and I want to contribute it. So the reason I want to write it is because it's Torah and I want to share Torah. But what's the format that I choose? I could write it as a standalone commentary, or I could write it as a commentary to the book that's being studied very often in today's world. Right? So it's not the primary motivation for publishing in the first place, but I might be savvy and say, well, if my goal is to teach as much Torah as possible, so then I want to be thoughtful about how I can ensure that the greatest number of people have the greatest likelihood of accessing this work. If my goal is to perpetuate Torah, if I'm going to publish something that will sit off in a manuscript in a corner for the next 1,000 years, that's not really achieving my ends. So let me publish it in a way that is most likely to reach a wider audience. That can be consistent with those same goals. You have this later on in Jewish history. For example, there's a classic commentary on Jewish civil law, on Choshen Mishpat, on monetary law, etc., written by the commentary is known as the Ktsot HaChoshen. It's a classic 18th century work. The Ksod HaChoshen was intentionally published not as a standalone work, but rather as a commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, because in 18th century Eastern Europe, Shulchan Aruch was very heavily studied. There were tons of commentaries being written, but if you write it as a commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, even though really it was more of a standalone work than a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, in all fairness, but he wrote it on the Shulchan Aruch with the hope that people would study it and that it would be influential, and so it was. That's exactly what happened. The Minchat Chinuch, writing of the 19th century from Constantinople, instead of writing a standalone commentary, writes one on the Sefer HaChinuch, the Minchat Chinuch to the Sefer HaChinuch. And you know what? There weren't too many outstanding commentaries on the Sefer HaChinuch, which was a pretty basic kind of work. Important, but very basic, list of the mitzvot, the rules, the reasons. The Minchat Chinuch publishes it on the Sefer HaChinuch, and now you have, right, people study the Sefer HaChinuch, ironically, from the Minchat Chinuch. It's now the classic commentary to the Sefer HaChinuch, right? And I have it right here on my shelf. Had the Minchat Chinuch, had Rav Yosef Baba, the author of that work, writing in 19th century Constantinople, published that as a standalone work, quite possible that it would have been lost to history, right? And then I wouldn't have it sitting right there, and we never would have heard of it. And so on Shabbat morning, I'm giving a chabura on the Minchat Chinuch, right? So it's one that we have in the shul, and they started at 8:45. They're all welcome to come. But the point is, there probably wouldn't have been a Minchat Chinuch, this chabura, this Shabbat, at Lower Merion Synagogue, if not for the Minchat Chinuch strategic decision to publish it on this commentary to the Sefer HaChinuch, as opposed to a standalone work, right? Now you can always say, well, that was God's, you know, God wanted it to work itself out a certain way. Don't tell Lisa. Jerry, what do you think? Fireworks, go. No, it's a different kind of topic. But, right. No, but in other words, right, but those kinds of decisions have ramifications for the unfolding of the intellectual history in ways that we might not expect, and that's true of the Ran as well. Ran, in addition to his halachic works and his novella to the Gemara, also has his drashot. The drashot Haran, which is one of the classic... it's a philosophical work. It's actually written as drashot in the sense that it's homiletical. It's structured around a series of talks that he gave on various parashot, and it's organized chronologically through Chumash. But there are only 12 drashot that we have printed, so it's not like he spoke on every one of the parashot HaShavua. It's just time to time. We have 54 parashot. He gave 12 talks. Nonetheless, although it's structured around Parsha and Chumash, these are clearly philosophical discourses. There was for some time a question as to the authorship of the Drashot Haran, whether it's the same as the Ran Rabbeinu Nissim that we have, of whose halachic commentaries we often are exposed. The consensus, the academic consensus, is that they're one and the same. The same Rabbeinu Nissim who wrote on the Gemara and Halacha and on the Rif, etc., is the same Rabbeinu Nissim who wrote these drashot. And the drashot are striking. Striking for a range of reasons. But one of the things that's really fascinating is that he touches on many modern themes. He's writing in the 14th century, but a number of the themes in Rabbeinu Nissim, who, by the way, I didn't mention, is from Girona, called Nissim of Girona. Rabbeinu Yonah is from the same town. They called Yonah HaGirondi. That's how he was known. It's the same town. And the Ran introduces many modern themes. He grapples with many modern aspects, especially in the civil legal system, or sort of the based-in structure. He talks about many really interesting ideas that have real modern resonance. In fact, there's an article by a contemporary scholar named Warren Zev Harvey, entitled something along the lines of Modern Themes in Drashot Haran, or in the writings of Nissim of Girondi, and he outlines a number of these. So, for example, the Ran has a classic piece, probably the most famous, this is 11th Drasha, in which he asks the question why we need multiple systems of enforcement or legal arms in the Jewish tradition. Because on the one hand, you have the Sanhedrin, but at the same time, you have the melech, you have the monarch. Both can punish. Right? We see instances, clearly, Beitin can issue punishments. Right? That's a thrust of one of the major roles of the Sanhedrin and the Melech. We have many instances in which the king can also issue punishment. We find that all over the place in Tanakh, just as an example. So the Ran asks why we need both. And he develops a theory that essentially there are two modes of enforcement or punishment, and really legislation more broadly, in the Jewish tradition. There's sort of the basic set of the letter of the law, and then there's sort of this extra legal, extra halachic category of punishments that that can be appropriated as well. The tractates in the Gemara discuss sort of the legal basics of the legal of our system. That's for the Beit Din, that's for the Sanhedrin to implement. But sometimes there are cracks in the system, right? There are all sorts of details, in particular in halacha, that if you just learn Masechet Sanhedrin, it's very hard to imagine, frankly, running a society in this way. For example, right? If we're talking about someone being punished for murder, so the halacha is you can only implement capital punishment, or the strict letter of the law is that that's the only punishment available to someone who kills, certainly intentionally. I mean, you have exile as an alternative, but assuming they don't qualify for going to an ir mikla, to a city of refuge, so you're going to put them to death if it's intentional. You can only put them to death if it's intentional if you have two witnesses who saw the event, warned the individual who is about to perpetrate the murder that if he violates or she violates this this act, that person will be put to death for the violation of the commandment of Ritzicha against murder. And within the period of roughly 3 seconds or so, the person has to respond, I know that, I'm going to do it anyway, afal pichein ani osen, nonetheless I'm going to do it. And then within the span of those 3 seconds, proceeds with the murder. 3 seconds. Warning. Yeah, what do I care? I'm going to do it anyway, whack. Right? That's pretty unlikely. In fact, it's almost implausible. It disqualifies probably 99.8% of capital murder cases, trials, for a murderer. So what happens to society? And the Gemara doesn't talk about jail anywhere. There's one example of kippah, but that's a different kind of punishment. Basically, there's no jail time in the Gemara. It doesn't exist. The Gemara doesn't talk about it. Rishon discuss. Doesn't mean that you can't do it, but it's not in the. It's just not there. So incarceration is not an option in sort of the basic. The Torah never talks about locking someone up, right? Like which passage and which section of Chumash, you know, throw them in prison, lock them up. So is that not an option? What do you do? So the Ran says built into the system is the second track, which is the role of the Melech, which is essentially there's an intentionally extra legal category that the king is meant to implement so as to avoid chaos in society. The first level is essentially the letter of the law, the divine will, and the second one is, well, we don't want chaos to ensue, we don't want society to dissolve, and that's the role of the king. In lieu, or in the absence of a king, both responsibilities fall to the Beit Din. They now accrue not only the basic letter of the law, but responsibility for that second level if there's no autonomous Jewish leadership or structure, etc. But essentially, we have both of these categories. This is extremely novel, and this is very interesting in terms of modern legal thinking and sort of asking ourselves the question, what's the relationship between the strict letter of the law and how society functions, right? Mm-hmm. And what is the purpose of law? Is it some higher divine will? Is it merely so that society does not integrate? There's a lot of legal theory about these kinds of questions, and the Ran very famously posits that both are true. In terms of, as well, balance of powers, right? He then expands this, by the way, talk about the role, where's the Navi fit into this, or the Chacham, or something like that, right? How do we, right? So then he speaks more broadly about the balance between political power and religious power, and Torah intentionally has a separation of powers, suggests the Ran. Now that's very modern, right? That's very resonant. So he has that as well, right? Two or three, right? Right? And he even talks about themes of checks and balances, etc. So I don't mean to say that it's the same exact, you know, it's just like the Federalist Papers. It's just James Madison, some 500 years earlier, whatever it was, 400 years earlier, but there's a lot of overlap and dialogue that's taking place, or can take place, between the Ran's legal theory on the one hand and modern Western, especially American legal theory on the other. So that's a really interesting example.
Yeah, but weren't there others who made this distinction between...
Sure, yeah.
Between the kahuna and the machlus?
Sure.
For instance, There are I think Rishonim even that are critical of the Chashmonaim,
the Ramban,
right?
The Ramban,
right?
Yeah,
because
it's part
because
of that tradition.
Of the fact that they merged.
That's right.
The two,
absolutely,
into one, and that led
with
to Mars, corruption.
You have Sur Shevet, right?
Right. So he's not the first one to
100%. I don't mean to say Zan. What's unique about the Ran is two things. Number one, he just develops it much more extensively than others, mm-hmm. and number two, he suggests it almost a prescriptive kind of way. In other words, I'm not saying that he's writing, he's saying, this is how we set up our government right now, but the others are sort of talking about, okay, so what went wrong at that time?
Right.
What happened, right? And he's writing, well, how should we set up a system of government? And there are contemporary issues that he's trying to work out, and that the responses that are written about this. In other words, what jurisdiction does the Jewish community have in terms of punishing its own? And there are real responses that are being written about these kinds of things in the Spanish Jewish communities at this time. So he's, I think, grappling with it in a different kind of way, although you're absolutely right. Yeah, he has roots, there are Talmudic roots for it, and then there are roots in the Spanish Jewish tradition, the Ramban, etc. I think that's right as well. Another really interesting example of his modern way about looking at. I don't mean to reduce it just to say, oh, the Ramban, you know, anticipated modern thought 500 years beforehand. Excuse me, and that legitimates him somehow or something like that. That's not fair to him, and that's also a simplification of his views. But I think that there's something interesting going on. So there's another example. He talks about the ideal composition of society, and he says something that seems pretty radical. I think it might be pretty radical, but I think it's really interesting and healthy food for thought. He asked the question, one of his drasho, why the Ketoret is composed of so many different kinds of incense, and why, moreover, not only there are 11 different types of incense, but if we miss any of those 11 ingredients, chayav mita, that's a capital offense. Right. Moreover, the Gemara in Masechet Kritut suggests that one of them was extremely foul-smelling. The chelbana, the frankincense, smelled terribly, except that when you put it together, you mix it together with the others, right? So then it had a sort of an elevating, right? Or somehow the mixture, right, elevated it, and now it smells beautifully. So the Ran suggests that this is a metaphor for society. The Ran goes so far as to say that we have quote-unquote foul-smelling individuals in society. We also know as the Risha'im. Right? Go compare this to the Haggadah. This is really interesting. Right? Next year at the Seder, mention the Ran as sort of an alternative way of thinking about this. Right? Although the truth is it's very relevant to Yom Kippur as well. Right? Because you have the idea of Nisach L'chol Adab in Israel. Right? Everyone's included in the community at this time. Yeah, no, I won't. I will. So what the Ran says, that I'm just keeping you in suspense, just in case anyone else forgot. Keeping here. Can't leave, sorry. So the Ran suggests that in fact the symbolism is applicable to our community, that the Rasha should not only be accepted within our community, but somehow is essential to the overall healthy functioning of our community.
It's a challenge to the community. I mean, it makes
you think
not just do things like a soldier.
You just have put them in harem and you're done. So if you have someone who seems to be very antagonistic, etc., don't always just take the knee-jerk way. I mean, he's giving a drasha, although it was given to his people. But he doesn't say, and therefore, you know, don't put Spinoza in Chirim. He doesn't say that. He was in Amsterdam in the 17th century either. But, right, it's not like that. But, and I don't know if there was a specific case. There's no evidence of that, so far as I know. But the point is, yes, he wants us to think about how to construct society. And it's you know, it's very interesting. Similarly, two things. Number one, this is also in addition to Yom Kippur and Pesach, a nice Svar Torah for Sukkot, of course, because you have the classic midrash about the Arba Minim, and each one, right, is the ones that smell right really well and taste good, and you have, right, the Arava is, of course, the bad one, right? The Arava is, right, looks bad, it looks ugly, and it smells terrible, and the whole nine yards. And yet it's part of the Arava Minim, right? I think that the Ran invokes that that example. And then here's also just, it's really interesting that of all people, Madison, James Madison, also in the Federalist Papers, discusses this as well in that same context. So you have a lot of points of contact between him and one of the founding documents, perhaps the most, you know, certainly after the Declaration of Independence, as a fully developed philosophical presentation of the underpinnings of the American government. There are a number of really interesting points of contact with the thought of the Ran, who's writing a long time before modernity. And there's, right, there's no Renaissance, there's no Enlightenment, there's no Ascala, there's none of these things. He's writing 14th century Christian Spain. So it's really very striking. Gotta run. Okay, no problem. We're finishing up. Just a minute. No problem. I just want to finish this line of personalities quickly with a few more. Nimuke Yosef, who's less well known, is already 14th to 15th century. But again, you see the continuity. The 14th century, I think, mostly early 15th century. And he's also published as a commentary on the Rif. In the back of the Gemara, in particular in Seder Nizikin, in areas of torts, of damages, of loans, of contractors, of different claims to property, and so on and so forth, these kinds of topics. So in the areas of Seder Nizikin, the Nimuke Yosef appears where the Ran does to the commentary of the Rif. In other areas of the Gemara, Nimuke Yosef, one of the next heirs to this Sephardic tradition, appears as well. I don't remember his last name. It's Shabini Yosef. I don't remember offhand and write it down. I don't remember. I don't even know how much we know about his biography. We don't have too much. But that's just another classic one in this tradition. And the two others that we didn't discuss are the Rush, whom I skipped over intentionally, I'll explain why, and the Tur. The Rush is living earlier, Rabbeinu Asher, also one of the classic commentaries in the Gemara, from 1250 to 1327. And then his 1250 to 1327. The Rush is fascinating because he, as opposed to all the others that we mentioned, who were all straight Spanish scholars, the Rush is born in Ashkenaz. He's born in France. He flees because of persecution and comes to Spain later on in life.
Where was he from?
He was from France.
France to Spain?
Yeah, he came from France to Spain. I don't remember offhand which town. But in France, but he comes from France to Spain, and so he fuses in many ways. We've been talking about the Ashkenazic tradition very much, but he takes the Ashkenazic tradition in many ways, fuses it with the Sephardic tradition, and he brings kind of the best of both worlds, or aspects of both, and also very interesting in terms of how it plays out in the Maimonidean controversy, right, and so on and so forth. But there's much more to say about the Rush. But the Rush also is a student of the Maharam Rutenberg. He was the one that we had mentioned who was imprisoned and died in 1290. And the Rush sees what happened to the Maharam Rutenberg and sees things going south. The Rush is also the up-and-coming Gadol Hador. He doesn't want to be similarly imprisoned and inflicted on his community. He flees in 1303, some 13 years after the Maharam died, 21 years after the Maharam is imprisoned. So he sees kind of what's going on. And then it's the Rush's son, there's the Rush who fuses the Ashkenazic and Sephardic traditions. His son is known as Rabbi Yaakov, the son of the Rush, son of, right, Ben Asher, Yaakov Ben Asher, who is the author of the Tur, of the Arba'at Turim. And the Tur, written by the Rush's son, is the first halachic work that moves fully, after the Rambam certainly, to move fully toward practical codification of tradition. So you have such a rich period of study, creativity, innovation in the earlier years, both in Ashkenaz with the Tosafists, Rashi's grandchildren, Rabbi Yotam, going from there for probably 200 years, and then parallel to that what we've been describing in Spain, and the Rush's son takes all of this and begins a period of crystallization. Very often in analytical history, intellectual history, you have periods of huge outbursts of creativity, and then at some point it becomes so much that there's a need after 100, 200 years, whatever it may be, to then take all of that information to begin to collate it into something that's manageable,
what
to codify it. Yaakov ben Harash. He's also known as the Baal HaTurim. He has a commentary to Chumash, but best known for his halachic work. The Tur is the first one to develop the four-part division of halacha into what we now know as the sections of Shulchan Aruch as well. The Shulchan Aruch was preceded by the Tur. The Tur says there are four parts. There's Orach Chaim we know of. Orach Chaim is daily life. So you have the laws of Tefillah, you have the laws of Brachot, etc. You have the laws of all the holidays, Shabbat and all the holidays. That's Orach Chaim. Choshen Mishpa, which we've mentioned, which is civil law, damages, torts, etc. Then you have Eben HaEzer, right? Order. Eben HaEzer is Jewish family law. Marriage, divorce, and so on and so forth. And then finally, you have Yoredeya, which we mentioned earlier as well, the laws of Yisur Veheter, Kashrut, and so on and so forth that we've mentioned. So that division of all summary of practical halakha into four segments, that is the innovation of the Torah, who takes the Ashkenazic tradition, marries it with the Sephardic tradition, which he had gotten both from his father, so he was well positioned to summarize both, and on the basis of all those rulings, most influenced by his father, but many others as well, he sets those all down in practical codification. So what you really see here is the Tur takes this tradition and begins to pull it together in a way that becomes more manageable. There's a lot more to say, but that's a pretty, I think, good overview of the major personalities. Moving forward, we have Maimonidean controversies. So we'll get a little bit more closely to some of the texts that were connected to that. And we have to circle back to the rise of Kabbalah and look at that a little bit more carefully as well.